Hi everyone, and welcome to the 9th episode of Zoology Ramblings with Roby and Emma.
Hello!
We're both here, surprise. Sorry it's been a while since we've put out any new content. We've been super busy with our other podcast series on the Biome Project, which has now just launched its website, so all of our cool content and filmmaking can be found there at biomeproject.co.uk. And we're also planning some really exciting new filming projects up in the Isle of Mull and down in Devon again. Spoilers, there will be beavers and there will be white-tailed seagulls. But we have returned.
So exciting.
And we're going to do this 9th episode of Zoology Ramblings. We're going to return to our usual format of we've each got an animal of the week. Emma's one's really weird.
What's new?
We've each got a global wildlife conservation story to tell you about, and just to save time, we've got we're splitting a UK conservation issue, and as with before, the podcast episode will be chopped into three sections, so you can pause or play or do whatever you need to do when you're listening. So we hope you enjoy this episode. Emma, do you want to take it away with your animal of the week?
Yeah, sounds good. It's exciting to do a ramblings episode because we haven't done one in a while. So I thought, because I haven't done something for a while, I'd go really niche and really obscure. So my animal this week is a fluorescent slug.
Excellent. I love it. It's, oh my God. Okay. So tell me about the fluorescent slug.
So it is in the genus Triboneophorus. Hopefully I said that right. And it's basically this neon hot pink slug.
I love it so much.
I mean, the colour is insane. I think because I was just on a random tangent about, I guess, slugs.
As you do.
And came across this very niche one. So why it is so, other than the fact that it's hot pink, it's very unusual because it's only found on this single mountaintop in northern New South Wales in Australia.
Love that. Can I just say, I really appreciated the pun. Like, it's a very niche slug, which is true, but like, it's also got a niche. And I assume it's like quite a narrow niche if it's only found on this one mountaintop. So I love it.
Great, unintentional pun, but... So yeah, it is found in this really, really unique niche in Mount Caputar National Park.
Ooh, gorgeous.
Which
name.
Is this mountain basically that used to be a volcano that's now extinct. And these hot pink slugs are found here and nowhere else in the world. And they can be up to 8 inches long.
Oh my God, that's a big slug.
Pretty big slugs.
That's, you know, I was about to get out of 30 centimetre ruler, but I actually don't have one, so I'm just going to imagine it. But that's a damn big slug. It's a lot bigger than any slugs you get in the UK.
Yeah, and like there's these videos of them. There's this awesome time lapse of them. What do they do? They don't crawl. What's a verb for a slug? How it moves?
I'm about to say you're the one telling me about these slugs. They slither, don't they slither?
That's a snake. I'm just going to say they move. Okay, like they. They move up and down this tree in a time lapse, and they're really big.
They slide.
It's really, really impressive. Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
can you slide up
with that?
Anyway, you know what? We're not going to talk about this anymore. Okay, moving on. Moving swiftly onwards. So here's a question: why are they bright pink? Because I'm looking at a photo of one now. They really are bright pink. And to all of our listeners, please Google these ridiculous slugs.
They are. They're an unnatural colour. But basically it's thought for kind of a two-way purpose, that it could be off-putting to predators as an indication of like, please don't eat me, but could also be because they are found on these beds of eucalyptus leaves, which are the same colour. And actually when you look at the slugs on the eucalyptus leaves on the floor, they're really, really well camouflaged.
So are you telling me that in Australia there is a forest full of hot pink trees and hot pink slugs? God really woke up one morning and decided, you know what, I'm going to put all the paint in my celestial jar into this one little corner of Australia, and I'm going to make everything pink.
It's a very, very unique part of the world.
It's niche.
And
it's
also
niche.
Quite... yeah. But also quite threatened, because it's this really small area and recently with the bushfires that sort of were raging across the area from October to December in 2019. Basically, they thought that all the slugs might have gone extinct because it's only a small population and it's isolated. But good news is they survived. Some of them did. 90% of them are thought to have been wiped out by the fire.
Oh, blimey.
So yeah, they've been hit hard, but that's one of the things that it highlighted, that global warming could really affect them badly, because they're already at the top of this volcano. They can't go any higher up. They can't flee to colder places because they are at the top of the volcano. Yeah, so that's just a funky overview of a neon hot pink slug, which you should definitely look up because they're awesome. Roby, do you want to talk about your animal this week?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, I've still got this neon pink slug in my head, but I'm going to go for a vertebrate this time. You know, probably just as endangered and not quite as weird looking, but for a vertebrate, pretty strange. So I am going to be telling you about the Hirola, also known as Hunter's Harter Beast or Hunter's Antelope. So if you didn't get it, it is an antelope. And its Latin name is Beatragus hunteri.
Ooh, I like the genus name.
It's quite a cool genus name, isn't it? And the Hirola is a member of the group Alcelaphinae, which is a subfamily within the Bovidae thing. So all your cows, your antelopes, your sheep and stuff, they're all in Bovidae. And then Alcelaphinae is the subfamily within that. And it includes other things like sesame, topi, bontebok.
Ooh, I like topi.
Yeah, all the really cool things which the South Africans probably are the ones who named, and they gave them, you know, names like blesbuck and hartebeest and yada, yada, yada. And so it was quite nice when I was researching this, going through all the other animals in Alcelaphinae, because I thought you just had sesame and hartebeest, but it turns out sesame has three species, including topi within them as subspecies. There's two bontebok, which I didn't even know there was one bontebok. Look up a bontebok. It's really cool.
I never heard of a bontebok, but okay.
It's like this. These are all weird antelopes. And then I thought there was only one hartebeest, and it turns out there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 hartebeests. How many wildebeest would you have thought there were?
One.
No, there is two species of wildebeest, the black and the blue, and the blue wildebeest has 5 subspecies. So anyway, enough on a random grouping of antelopes, but they just kind of blew my mind. And the Hirola is a bit odd because it looks very strange. In my opinion, it's the most beautiful bovid. I know, you can really tell I'm a nerd when I've got a most beautiful bovid, haven't I? Emma, what's your most beautiful bovid?
I'd probably say topi, actually.
Oh, you like a topi, do you?
I really like a topi. I don't know why. I just like
cool.
Topi.
That's cool. I like a Hirola.
But these are really odd looking.
she says odd, I say beautiful. They're this beautiful kind of golden colour. They've got these, I think they're called lyrate horn shapes, in that they look a bit like a lyre, I guess. Ramrod straight up from the head, and a little V. And they've got these fantastic eye glands called suborbital glands. So I don't know if you've ever seen a deer or a cow in heat when it's trying to mate. They've got these weird glands which open up in front of their eyes. And with Hirola, because they're entirely gold, but their eyes and these glands are really white and they face forward, so it looks like it's got 4 eyes when it's looking at you.
It's quite disconcerting, I have to say. I'm looking at a picture of one now. And if you focus on the glands and not the eyes, I really feel like I'm getting a death stare from this antelope.
I mean, weirdly, it's giving me alien vibes. It's quite an unusual antelope. And no one was quite sure where it went. People thought maybe it was in with the hartebeest in the genus Alcephalaphus. And some people it was in with the sesames and the topes in, I think, Damalascus is the genus. But then it was figured out that neither hartebeest nor sesames do the phlegmon response. You know, when like deer do that thing where they pull their lips up.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
But Hirola do. And so that was kind of the thinking behind giving it its own genus. And unfortunately, a bit like your neon pink slug, this beautiful, elegant antelope is thought to be the most endangered antelope in the world.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that human pressures?
Oh, you guessed it.
Oh, what a guess.
I know. I mean, I've never heard that one before. So they live on the Kenyan-Somalian border. So already a pretty unstable politically area. And they don't live in protected reserves either.
Right, okay. That I can see why that would be problematic.
Yeah. Somalia is a failed state. There's hella civil wars going on, and that part of Kenya is pretty far from the capital, and therefore authority in managing wildlife and protecting habitats is pretty poor. Completely adding to the fact is this is basically a semi-desert. It's a very arid kind of bush savanna area with very little drinking water. But that's not the main thing, because obviously they're involved in this environment and Hirola are pretty good. They're a desert specialist species. Okay, maybe not desert, but arid species.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got a kind of typical herd structure for a mid-sized antelope. So they live in kind of fission fusion herds. A single male will dominate over the females, and then to give birth, the female will leave the herd to give birth alone and then return. And unfortunately, this kind of leaving the herd behavior leaves females very open to predation when they're giving birth. You've also got a massive outbreak of rinderpest in that area,
because that basically decimated wildebeest population.
And obviously Somalia and northern Kenya, Ethiopia as well, were hit by a load of droughts. And then in a drought situation, you've got native antelope competing for resources with domestic livestock who are guarded by people with guns. So that's always an encounter that a native species is going to lose. And actually, really interestingly, and I wonder what you think of this, having spent quite a bit of time in East Africa, they're really threatened by what's called bush encroachment, which is not necessarily a human-driven scenario, but it's what happens when you shoot all the elephants in an area, and because the elephants aren't maintaining this open landscape, forest actually grows up, and the Hirola, which are these bush specialists, are kind of forced out.
I think, thinking about it now, that definitely is something that has happened in places like Ethiopia, because you don't have any of the big megafauna like elephants anymore. But in a way, some of that role has been taken over by livestock, I think, in much of East Africa, where they're allowed, if, especially like you're saying, if the Hirola aren't in national parks, if you've got goats and cattle and various things like that grazing, that might kind of fill the role that the elephants once had.
I guess you probably would have a bit more opening up, although I imagine the big you know draw of the elephants is they literally pull over trees.
Yeah, but I think that just shows that elephants are massive ecosystem engineers, and without them it's
we love an ecosystem engineer, don't we? Elephants,
we do.
Beavers. No more spring to mind in my head, but I'm sure wildebeest, there you go
wolves.
So yeah, the Hirola is having a really hard time of it. Not only is the place where it's naturally living a bit of a war zone at the moment, you know, you've got all these militias and bushmeat hunting trade, you've also got its habitat declining. But there is hope for the Hirola, this beautiful, beautiful antelope. So there are...
That's good.
Yeah, there are two rays of hope. So the first is Tsavo East National Park. It's a very famous national park in Kenya. And around 70 individuals have been translocated into Tsavo East. And they reckon there's now around 70, a few more in Tsavo East. So that's another population centre where even if they go extinct in the natural range, they'll survive there. And it's thought in the natural range there's probably around 300 left. But a really nice little project that's happening is... a project that's happening in actually on the Kenyan-Somalian border, for local communities in Ijara district, in collaboration with an NGO called Terra Nuova, have established the Ishakbini Hirola Conservancy, which is a 23-kilometer fenced, predator-proof sanctuary with a founding population of 48 Hirola, which are apparently doing well. So there is hope for this Hirola. This beautiful, beautiful antelope. It's my favourite bovid.
No, that's really good that there is some hope for it, because like you say, when you've got political turbulence as well as extreme climates, it's quite hard for them to bounce back from that if the ecosystem isn't kind of balanced like it used to be, maybe.
And, you know, if you're perhaps interested with the Hirola, if you look up, they are just one of a whole suite of kind of arid African land mammals which are really being hit hard in that corner of eastern Africa. There's, I think, three other rare antelope species in the area, including two which have gone extinct in the last 100 years because of all the kind of chaos of that particular corner of that bit of Africa. So yeah, it's a whole wormhole to go down, trust me. I've been reading about desert antelopes all day. It's been great.
Well, it's a bit depressing.
Yeah, a bit depressing, but yeah. So that is the end of part one of this podcast. Stay tuned for part two, where we talk about global conservation issues.
So, hi everyone, and welcome back. This is part two of episode 9 of Zoology Ramblings. In this section, we are going to talk about global conservation issues, challenges, topics, whatever you want to call them. And so we are going to start by talking about elephants and the ivory trade. So this was actually a request by someone who listened to our podcast. So thank you, Emma, for the request. Really appreciate you asking us to do this, because really enjoyed researching it, and it's something that I think is very important and people should know about. So, I mean, there's so much. Where do we even start with elephants?
Where do we start with elephants? Emma, what is an elephant? Tell me what an elephant is.
Okay, that's a good place to start. So, elephants are the largest land mammals on Earth. They can weigh up to 7 tons.
That's a lot of tons.
It is a lot of tons because, okay, I got this remarkably wrong last time. How much does a car... Is a car about a ton?
I mean, some cars are about a ton. My car is about... Okay, there you go. You've been in my little green car.
Yeah.
That's about half a ton. Whereas I would probably say your parents' car might be 3/4 of a ton. And then my dad's car, which is a... I don't know what it is, actually. I think it's a German car. It's like a... That's a ton.
Okay. Yeah, so if you think of like a large car... and have 7 of those, then that would make up the weight of an elephant. And this is like the big male bulls. And they can be 3.5 meters tall at the shoulder. And they spend a lot of their day eating. So it can be up to 18 hours a day, and they can just, where they're foraging and eating, and they can eat up to 400 kilos of food in a day.
I'm sure if this was a proper documentary, that they'd say, yeah, that's the equivalent of like 300 hamburgers, but I actually think it's probably a lot more than that.
400 kilos of food, that is... I can't even put into perspective what that is, that we'd have to eat the equivalent, because also we would die if we ate 400 kilos of food, just saying.
Many, many McDonald's. And I think the reason, aside from being these iconic, huge things, I think the reason everyone loves elephants is their social lives, isn't it? You see all these documentaries where it's the mum and the baby, and they all gather around to protect the baby from the hyenas. And the reason I really like elephants is the fact that it's the matriarch who leads them. And then, you know, it's subordinate to her or her sisters and then aunts. And it's all this lovely cascade of wisdom being passed down. I think it's lovely.
I just think it's fascinating. Like the knowledge that they have and the knowledge that they can pass on to individuals is just so complex. So with the matriarch, it would be the most experienced, oldest female who will remember where the watering holes are, which trees are good to feed off of, which ones... which roots are safe and which aren't. Like, all of this knowledge is passed on, which is incredible, I think. And so it's mainly a female-orientated social structure. The males kind of either live in isolation, you often see these rogue bulls just kind of wandering aimlessly, or they sometimes form, like, smaller bachelor-like pods as well. But it's mainly the females and their calves. And they tend to have one calf about every 4 to 5 years. And they actually have the longest gestation period of any mammal, which is 22 months.
Wow. Even longer than a whale. So... That was such a sigh. I was like, Roby, why did you ask me this question? Oh my god.
I would need to check that. I don't want to say something wrong. But definitely of any land mammal, I'll say that. Yeah, so obviously that's a little bit of an overview of their social structure. Do you want to talk a bit about kind of the different elephants that we have, Roby? Like the African versus the Asian elephants?
So there are actually, most people think there are two species of elephant, right? The Asian elephant and the African elephant. But there are actually three. You've got the one Asian species, which is split into three subspecies, the Indian, Sumatran, and Sri Lankan elephants. And then you actually have two distinct species of African elephant. You've got the savanna elephant and the forest elephant. So odds are, if you're watching a wildlife documentary in Africa and you've got elephants gambling across the plains, I don't know, do elephants gamble? I think they gamble. The plains, that's the savanna elephant, and it's the big one. It's the biggest land animal. The forest elephant is the ones you'll see when David Attenborough is taking you into the Congo, and there's these great clearings in the Congo, and you get these elephants which are coloured because of the mud they've been rolling in, and weird spotty antelopes.
They're slightly smaller, aren't they, the forest ones?
So in terms of size, it goes African savanna, Asian, and then African forest elephant. And what is quite interesting, actually, is there is a lot of contention about the Asian subspecies. So we know we've got three, the Indian, Sumatran, and Sri Lankan. But elephants used to live all the way through the Middle East up to Syria. And so there was a population of Asian elephants called Syrian elephants. And they were actually big. They were African elephant size.
Wow.
And so there's a lot of debate about whether that was just a larger population of Indians or whether that was a distinct subspecies. And you've also got pygmy elephants on the island of Borneo in Southeast Asia, and no one's quite sure what's going on with them either, because they're obviously very small because of selective pressures of living in an island environment, but there's no fossil evidence of them. They just kind of popped up, and so there's a lot of debate about, were they a population of Sumatran elephants that were introduced by people during medieval prehistoric times, or are they just a really kind of cryptic different subspecies. And there's also, which is completely tinfoil and crackpot, a proposed subspecies or even species of Asian elephant called the Kalana pygmy elephant. So in Papara Forest in the very deep south of India, the local people know of two types of elephant, the big Asian elephant and then the smaller Kalana, which is apparently, you know, a dwarf. And it's never been described, but there have been some photographs taken. Obviously, these are always photographs where the elephant has nothing next to it for scale because it's in the middle of a wood, so it's very hard to determine. But there may be, maybe, possibly, if we're lucky, a tiny dwarf species of elephant in India.
That would be amazing if there was. I just find dwarfism as a concept, like not only on islands, but like where animals have gotten smaller, just... Yeah, it would be amazing. Can you imagine seeing one, just wandering, and you come across this tiny elephant?
But for the sake of argument, we're going to say that there are three species of Asian elephant, and they're quite different. So African elephants, you can always tell because their back is held slightly flat, their hind legs are the same height as their front legs, and their ears, they've got the big ears, and the ears look like the shape of Africa.
That's what I find fascinating. I love that about the ears, that kind of the Asian ones, it looks like India, and then the African ones, it looks like the shape of the continent of Africa. I just love that.
And so Asian ones also have a bit smaller ears. And it's thought that invariably Asian elephants live in slightly cooler habitats, so the ears are used in thermoregulation to cool the blood as they get waved. There's another difference in the tusks. So in Asian elephants, it's usually only the males which have tusks. You do get a few tusking females, but usually only the males. And they're usually shorter than African elephants. Whereas in African elephants, both sexes have tusks, although males are much larger in tusks. And male elephants are bigger than females anyway. So these different types of elephant also face different pressures. So in Africa, their main kind of threat is ivory hunting, whereas in Asia and in particular in Sumatra, the biggest kind of enemy to elephants is habitat destruction via palm plantations. So that's a quick, well, maybe a bit more of an in-depth overview of the different types of elephants, I really like it because everyone assumes, oh, look, there's just two elephants. But actually, there's hella elephants and they're all completely different. So why don't we talk a bit about why elephants are important? What's their role in the ecosystem? Why do we care? Why do we care? And then we'll go into ivory hunting.
Yeah, no, that sounds good. Because we should care about elephants. So it's important that we tell people why they're important. So like we kind of mentioned earlier about elephants being these ecosystem engineers, they basically can maintain and shape their forest or savanna ecosystems, depending on which species that you're talking about. And through doing this, they can boost biodiversity of other species as well. So they'll clear these pathways, like if you've seen the Jungle Book, where they, it's maybe slightly exaggerated, where they all march and sing and like plow down these trees. They will create these paths that allows passages for other animals. So these microhabitats, they're important. And then, oh, you got another footprint story. I love microhabitats of footprints. This was something that we did in a biome podcast. If you haven't listened to it, it was about bison footprints. That's just for context. So basically, elephant footprints, they're very, very large. Because if you think of the size of the animal, they have big feet. And these can act as microhabitats as well. So they can fill with water. They can allow some seeds to germinate and things like that. They can also be home for tadpoles. And then, do you want to talk a bit about like how they disperse seeds? Because that's like
I would love to. I love elephant dispersing seeds. And people accuse us of being niche. So
elephant, don't know what they're talking about.
Because elephants are so big and they're so tall, they can basically eat. They can basically reach any food that they need to. So they have a massive range of diet, and that means they take in a whole load of seeds and plant material. And they're also, A, really long-distance migrants, and they also roam really far every day, even when they're not migrating. And so they disperse these seeds through their poo. There's been some very interesting studies showing that actually seeds that have gone through the digestion of an elephant and germinate in their poo actually germinate much better and much more efficiently. I don't know if better and efficiently is the right way to describe it, but they're definitely healthier plants. And it's estimated that up to a third of tree species in Central African forests, so places like the Congo, rely on elephants in this way for the distribution of seeds, which is astonishing.
That's phenomenal.
And it also kind of makes you think what we must have lost in Europe when we got rid of all our mammoths and our interglacial elephants, species like Paleoloxodon, the ancient straight-tusked elephant. Like, our native flora grew up and evolved with these elephants. So I'm sure, you know, oak trees are doing a massive disservice because they're not being, are being done a massive disservice because there's no elephants to kind of trample their seeds around, which is, you know, a food for thought. And the other thing about elephants is they kind of create their own ecosystem. They trample the forest down and they create the typical African savanna. This is a creation of the elephants, these low bushes with acacia trees. This environment exists because you've got these elephants coming through and just kind of ripping the place up. So elephants are clearly hella important.
I think an often overlooked, like you were mentioning, bringing that context back to Europe, it's something that they've been regulating ecosystems for thousands and thousands of years. And when we haven't grown up with that, or we're not used to them in an ecosystem, we kind of forget what we've lost, I think.
I think it's a really nice example of how, you know, as each generation grows and dies and grows and dies, your baseline for what you think is normal shifts. So we think that elephants are African animals which inhabit an African ecosystem. And if you put them in Europe, they'd be out of place. Or if you put them in North America, they'd be out of place. Which completely ignores the fact that for most of the existence of elephants as a concept, as a group, they've been all over the place. Europe evolved alongside the elephant, as did Asia, as did North America, as did South America. Different types of elephant. You've got gompatheres in South America and mammoths in the north and straight-tusked elephants in the middle. Stegodons went wild in South Asia. There's so many stegodons. We think that, oh, elephants are an African thing and they're an African problem and an African solution, but ignoring the fact that before we turned up and ate them all, they used to be everywhere. Everywhere had elephants.
And I think, yeah, that's maybe a good way to talk about, so now, yes, they were kind of driven to extinction in various places in the past, but they are now facing a lot of threats currently in modern society. So their numbers have plummeted quite significantly. So in the 1970s, there were about 1.2 million African elephants, and there are now about 400,000, possibly less. I was reading a paper that was in more like the 350,000 range.
It's not so many African elephants when you think about it.
It's not, when you compare that to, in that same period of time, the human population has quadrupled. I think that just, that goes to show how, again, kind of with the rise of humans, that has been come at the cost of species like the elephants.
And with the ivory trade, it gets a lot of attention. And I think one of the reasons it gets a lot of attention is because it's completely bogus, right? Ivory is just enamel, isn't it? Just teeth? Like, elephant tusks are teeth. Ivory from an elephant is no different from an ivory from a hippopotamus, or surely even you and I. It's just dentine, is it not?
Yeah, it's... I mean, there's only a few species that have ivory, but it is a certain type of tooth. It's not hugely different to our own, except they're a lot more impressive and awesome looking. But yeah, like, ivory is found in elephants, hippopotamus, walrus, warthogs, sperm whales, and narwhals. So they're all the animals that have ivory.
So that's interesting. But... is ivory a particular type of tooth material? So do we not have ivory in our teeth?
No, we don't. I don't know if it's whether it's describing what it is or how it grows, because if you think about all of them, it's the tusk-like formation. So I think it has a link with that.
And elephants use an elephant is kind of made by its tusk, isn't it? The tusk and the trunk are what makes the elephant, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Their tusks are so important to them. And I didn't know this, but elephants can either be right or left tusked.
Ooh, so, isn't that like, sweet?
In a similar way that we are right or left-handed, you'll see that often one tusk is more worn down and shorter, because that means they're using that one more, which I really like that.
I mean, everyone always says, you know, humans, we're the alpha, you know, we're the exceptional species. We're really not that different, are we? Every time no. I learn about a new interesting fact, the line for me between human and the rest of the animal kingdom gets so much more blurred.
It so does, like, and if even more, like, if you think about what they're using their tusks for, it's the same kind of thing we'd use our hands and our teeth for. So it's moving objects, gathering food, stripping bark off of trees. Maybe we don't do that as much, but, like, you know, like, same kind of thing.
You don't know what I go and do in the forest. I mean, let's not assume here.
Okay, like, you can go rip bark off trees, that's fine.
I'm simulating elephants in my natural forest because I want to rewild it, and yeah, it's fine.
So that just, I think, a little overview of why it's so important to the elephants. Then if we look at ivory in its form of the trade, I think that's when that's what everyone knows ivory to be. So ivory is often formed into these carvings, like really, really intricate carvings or jewellery, and China is still the biggest consumer for ivory.
It's interesting you say that. This is completely just butting in with a personal anecdote. My grandparents used to live in Zambia and Malawi back in the 70s. And I was talking to them actually in preparation for this podcast. And I remember saying, oh, you know, was there much ivory kicking about when you were there? And my grandma was like, yeah, you could buy it all the time everywhere. And at the time, it was thought of as just a commodity. And so she actually showed me. She's got a big chunk of carved ivory in her house, which wow. She was using to hold her bedroom door open. And it's exquisitely carved in the face of a lady with a big kind of headdress. And so, yeah, it at the time... where at the height of the poaching and ivory trade, it was ubiquitous.
I think that's the thing to highlight. Like, basically, it was in the 70s and 80s that the demand just skyrocketed, but ivory was being sold legally. Like, people in Europe or the US or in different parts of the world were able to buy it so easily, but the way that it was being removed from the elephants was illegal at the time, but people didn't know about it. Because we're not going to go into too much. You can look this up in your own time because we don't want to disturb you. But it's very, very gruesome how that they harvest ivory. Basically, the whole kind of face is removed and what's left is horrible. It's not.
The tusk is obviously a tooth and it's embedded really deep into the skull. And so you can't just cut it off on the outside of the face, because then you're leaving potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars still in the skull. So that's why they have to take the whole the whole front of the head off, which is horrific. And, you know, if you do look it up, you trigger warning.
I don't think anything can prepare anyone for seeing that for the first time.
So what's the timeline we're looking at here? I mean, we know it started in the 70s and in the 80s, but, like, how has that progressed?
Yeah, so I think it's good to do an overview of what's happened with ivory. Yeah, so like we were saying, in the 70s and 80s, there was this massive, massive demand for ivory. It wasn't really regulated. It was just people didn't really make the link between ivory and the gruesome atrocity that was happening to elephants. So then it was in 1989 that CITES, which is this convention on the international trade in endangered species, they banned the trade of African elephant ivory. And this was also when elephants were put on Appendix 1 of CITES. So animals that are on that list means that all international trade of that species is forbidden, as are the products, basically. And this is when people started to actually question what ivory meant, and people in Europe and the US actually started to say no to ivory once they made this connection. And so prices basically dropped, and the ban was really, really effective for about 10 years, like super, super effective. And the elephant numbers started to recover, and it was looking very positive. Some people say that that decision was one of the best decisions for elephants, that in 1989, the CITES thing. So yeah, the elephant numbers were doing really, really well for this 10-year period, basically. Mm-hmm. And poaching rates dropped. But what happened was, what's been described as, someone described it as, like, kind of the world's most horrendous mistake, mm-hmm. on CITES' part. So that was in 1997.
Yeah.
Basically, because the population had been growing and elephants were doing well,
yeah,
there were several South African countries that lobbied CITES and basically said, look, the elephants are doing well now. Can we have this one-off sale, mm-hmm. where we sell all our stockpiles of ivory and get rid of it? Mm-hmm. And CITES said yes.
Hmm.
So basically, CITES granted this permission in 1999 for this one-off sale, mm-hmm. which turned out to be another one-off sale in 2008. Mm-hmm. And interesting, we've talked about this, Roby, because this idea of flooding the market with legal ivory, mm. and like with rhino horn as well, like, would this be effective? Mm. And it decimated elephant populations. It was not effective at all.
So why did it decimate them?
Because basically, as soon as you had this flooding of legal ivory, mm. it basically gave people the message that the value of ivory was rising again, and that it gave people the hope as well that the market would eventually open one day. So people started stockpiling massively for the hope that it would then open again.
Right.
So basically, as ivory from the legal sale became available, there were record numbers of illegal ivory seizures all around the world. So, and the thing is, you can't tell the difference between legal and illegal ivory.
Yeah, I guess so. You can't just put a sticker on it, can you?
Yeah, exactly. So people were using up their legal stocks and then just stocking it up with illegal stocks, yeah. so that they could keep selling it. So it was a bad decision, I think, on CITES' part to allow that to happen.
Wow.
And so since then, I think the elephant populations haven't really recovered. Currently, it's, I think, about 55 elephants are killed every day.
Ouch.
Globally.
And so where is the market for ivory? Where is all this ivory going?
So currently, it's mainly to Asia and predominantly China.
Okay, yeah, heard that one before.
yep, they are big players in the wildlife trade area. But I guess to mention some positive recent changes that have happened. So in 2015, there was an agreement between the US government and China to ban the ivory trade completely. Mm-hmm. So that was a positive step. And then in China, in 2018, they actually banned the domestic trade of elephant ivory, which was a huge, huge step.
I actually hadn't heard of
so
that.
I thought they were still going. Yeah. I mean, it's not to say there isn't illegal stuff going on, but
yeah, you can't exactly ban illegal trades because it shouldn't be happening in the first place. So it's all very well saying, oh, we've banned the elephant trade, but you haven't banned the illegal trade, have you?
Yeah, but it's looking promising. Like, prices of ivory, even on the black market, are thought to be declining. And with countries like China taking steps like this, it is a bit more promising, I think.
Interesting. And I guess, yeah, we need to learn from the mistake that CITES made in 1999, that you can't really ever really take your foot off the pedal with this. You've got to keep the pressure on. You've got to keep saying, yeah, no, you can't do this. And I think now, well, it's good that they've now got rid of the domestic ivory trade. Now you really got to hit the illegal ivory trade hard. And I think that kind of nicely leads into a comment I'd just make about the whole kind of poaching crisis, is that it's very easy to demonize the people who are actually doing the poaching, you know, the people who are going and hacking the faces of elephants. But that's not really, in my opinion at least, where the most effort should be spent on tackling the problem, because the effort kind of needs to be focused, in my opinion, and I'm not someone who specializes in this field, so do feel free to shout me down. You've got to tackle the supply, and because without the supply, there's no reason to go and hack an elephant's face off. So I think once you can take, you know, the big, and this is a criminal enterprise, these are cartels and organized gangs making millions and millions out of this. Once you take them out of the equation, with the supply gone, you'll find much lower rates of poaching anyway. The other way I think you'd get around it is by making poaching less profitable than environmental and sustainable development, in particular working with wildlife. Because, you know, poaching, a single pair of elephant tusks could provide someone in dire circumstances with enough money to get their entire family through the year, buy them healthcare, and, you know, put their children into school, which is something which absolutely we all need to be doing in places like East Africa. And, you know, if I was in that position, I'd absolutely make that call, because if it's a choice between feeding my family or elephants, who have never particularly helped me anyway because they trample my fields, you know, you'd make that call as well. So I think, yeah, I think the number one thing that the global community needs to do is just keep enforcing the pressure on not just legal Chinese trade, but illegal Chinese trade. And bits of it do go through, you know, Vietnam and Thailand, and that should also be tackled as well.
No, absolutely. I fully agree with that. Like, I think it's good to mention that we shouldn't blame the people for the circumstances they are in.
Especially since half the time we put them in those circumstances by turning up with a warship and nicking their country in the first place. Oh, sorry, I'm getting all political.
No, but a good point to make, because we have a role to play in why some people are living the way that they are around the world today. So I guess something maybe positive to mention that kind of draws on that. It's a really, really awesome project. So it's called Elephants and Bees Project.
Ooh.
And there's an awesome, awesome TED Talk. I'll put the link in the description so you guys can watch it. So it was founded by someone called Dr. Lucy King.
Ooh, I've heard of her.
And she's the elephant, like, the elephant person.
She's the elephant person.
So basically what she was doing with, like, she grew up in Africa, she moved to Kenya and spent her life sort of understanding elephant behaviour. And this is when she kind of started to realise the extreme issues that you have with human-elephant conflicts where, I mean, credits to the elephants, they are very, very, very intelligent, and that however many electric fences you put up, they find a way of trampling them.
Oh, they always will. I remember I was in Zambia one time, and we were driving through a game management area on our way into the national park, and I remember thinking, that's a big fence, and it is lying on the ground, and it is broken. I remember saying, what tore down that fence? And the chap looked at me and said, elephants. And these are big steel poles which have just been bent. Yeah. And I was like, oh my god, I don't want to come across an elephant in a dark night.
I mean, there was a brilliant one as well where they designed these supposedly elephant-proof electric fences where the electric bit was high up, and so the understory bit was open so that other animals could pass. The elephants just crouch down on all fours and slide under the fence.
Belly sliding elephants, I love it.
Literally.
They woke up one morning and they decided, no, we do not hold truck with electric fences.
Exactly, which was, I was quite amused seeing them going under this fence. But So basically what Dr. Lucy King was doing was she decided to look at the use of beehives as a natural elephant deterrent.
Intriguing.
Because basically there had been stories from people who'd lived in the bush that they said that elephants avoid trees that had these wild beehives on.
Mm.
And so elephants have very thick skin. It's thought, I think it's like 2 centimeters thick. Mm. But they will, these bees will sting kind of around the eyes, like around the ears and in the trunk. And what with African honeybees, they release pheromones when they sting so that all the other bees in the colony will then go and sting in the same spot. So that's very, very unpleasant, as you can imagine, for elephants. So like we were saying with the matriarch, who has a lot of wisdom that she passes on, trees that have African honeybees will be avoided. Mm. And so basically it started off that they would play the sounds of African honeybees to these elephants and see how they reacted. And basically they fleed every time and had this very kind of alert response.
Oh my goodness.
She's like, okay, they flee to the sound of it, so let's think how we can work with this. And so basically what they designed was these beehive fences in these small farms where humans and elephants were competing for space. Mm-hmm. And so what they've done, which is quite cool as well, so they've got 12 beehives. They're basically suspended on a wire with like a roof to shade the hive. Mm-hmm. And so you've got 12 actual beehives with real bees in them. Mm-hmm. And then you've got 12 dummy hives, which are just like pieces of wood painted yellow because that halves the cost of the fence.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But still tricks the elephants. And it's been hugely successful.
I was going to say, has this actually worked? Because that is bonkers and I love it.
It's bonkers and it works. So these fences have actually kept up to 80% of the elephants outside the farms.
Oh, wow.
So they have used like night vision camera traps as well. And even at night when most of the raiding happens, the elephants don't cross these bee fences.
And I guess because of this, I guess having these bees around is just a good idea anyway, because presumably they'll pollinate your fields, and honey is always something you can sell and eat and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. It's another economic incentive for the farmers as well, and also they're trying to encourage the farmers to grow sort of bee friendly crops, so things like sunflowers, things like chili, ginger as well. So they're plants that have flowers, but elephants don't particularly like eating.
Okay.
And there was a really cool one as well. It's sizzle, which sizzle. I think some...
Interesting.
Sizzle.
Does it sizzle?
I mean, it might. It's also called jute.
Oh, I've heard of jute.
Yeah. That's probably the more well-known. I've never heard of sizzle. So what this can be used, it's good for the bees as well, but it can also be made into baskets and things like that. So it's actually then empowering women to be beekeepers, basket weavers, and then they can use the chili and the sunflower to turn into oil. And so it's this whole little self-sustaining community now because of these beehive fences.
What a fantastic idea. I love that. And I guess, so that's a really lovely idea of how human-elephant coexistence can occur, and I guess that reduces the losses of elephants to angry farmers in like revenge killings for raiding crops. It's probably like worth mentioning that WWF are doing a load of really cool stuff, strengthening anti-poaching initiatives and stopping the illegal ivory trade on like a bigger scale, but I love hearing about these little nice little projects which are trying to make everyone better in the long run.
Yeah, no, that one I thought was such a fantastic idea, and one that has been implemented now across Africa and across Asia. So very, very successful, I think. So that's
fantastic.
A positive elephant conservation story. So I think that's maybe a good place just to round up on a positive elephant conservation story. So hopefully you learnt some interesting facts about elephants, and also
I did.
Maybe... Me too. And hopefully maybe realise why we should care about them and protect them a little bit more. So basically treat this like an intermission because we've rambled quite a lot. So in the next podcast, we are going to talk about our second global conservation topic and also the UK one.